Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. That means only one thing. It is true crime time. Is there a crime in this one? yes, there actually is a crime in this one because we don't know who did something. So there is a crime that we will attempt to solve. But I am joined by Jen. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I mean, there is a crime in this one.
There's lots of little mini crimes. And if you think about it, you know, as we go into the story, there might be moral crimes.
Well, there's definitely, it's Hollywood. There's always moral crimes in Hollywood. I mean, it's just, that's what it is. I find this, I found this entire thing fascinating. And I'm excited to talk about it. And it involves, I guess, you know, kind of the Titanic and Hollywood and more Titanic. And I just find it, really interesting, all kind of Titanic stuff. Except
I never really thought about having a Hollywood link outside of that of, you know, like say like the film premiere, you know, James Cameron's movie or something like that. But I mean, this is really in debt to deal with the Titanic. And it's probably a story that not many people have ever heard of.
I actually saw a Titanic exhibit at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library had this Titanic exhibit, and it was stuff from the movie. It was stuff from, it was interesting. There was this one thing, and I can't recall if it was, like it's not actually from the Titanic, but I think that they had it made and stuff, and it was like an extra suite, and JP Morgan, I think, was supposed to be on the Titanic. And it just had like what his suite looked like and everything like that. And I mean, just it was pretty incredible. And, you know, where the Titanic is. And I mean, they did have some things from the actual Titanic, which is, you know, considering how long it takes to get there and stuff. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I love that. They used to have a couple of exhibits that would travel around state to state, especially states that had aquariums, you know, really large aquariums like Tennessee Aquarium, Georgia Aquarium, things like that. They would set up these little pop-up shops that you could just walk between and you could view the history and then also buy little souvenirs and stuff. But the one at the Tennessee Aquarium, the one at the Georgia Aquarium are supposed to be really haunted. And they actually set up cameras and you can see stuff move around at night. And if you're into that kind of stuff, you know, definitely go and check that out. But when it comes to JP Morgan, you brought up like a very interesting thing because at the last minute, that guy canceled off. And it's like, what did he know?
You wonder because, I mean, this was sad. I mean, this cabin, I was like, I don't remember if it was, it's been a couple of years since the exhibit was there, but, you know, it was, you know, was it specially made for him and stuff? But, and did he send his secretary? I can't even remember anymore, but I just know that he was supposed to go and, and I wonder, like you said, did he know something?
Didn't his family have something to do with the financing of the ship?
Yeah, yeah. And
so, yeah, so that's probably why he was going to be there. And then you look and see how involved they were, and you think, why did a guy like that not board? And he claimed that he was sick, right? But he was actually seen out with his girlfriend at the time, and they were giggling and just strolling about, and he didn't look sick. So that's always been...
Maybe he just wanted to be with his girlfriend, didn't want to go on a trip. The...
And then I saw something recently. He didn't want to get on the boat, but hey, maybe he thought it was going to sink.
And then I saw something recently that said, oh, the Titanic didn't even hit an iceberg. I was like, whoa, whoa.
There are so many theories coming out now. You know, maybe it didn't hit an iceberg. Maybe a U-boat was involved. I mean, conspiracy theories for days.
Exactly. So, but let's talk about, we're going to talk about Dorothy Gibson, who was a silent film star. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Dorothy?
She was actually on the maiden voyage of the Titanic, and she survived it. She was someone that was literally on the very first boat that dropped into the water, you know, the very first lifeboat. And to me, that is just absolutely incredible. And she went on to be a silent film star, and we'll get into the type of things that she went on to film.
So she's there. She's a silent film actress because it's in 1912. There's no talkies yet or anything like that. And she survived that, but maybe not the curse that followed it. Because if you think about it, only about a third of all the passengers aboard the Titanic lived. I mean, it hit an iceberg. We'll say that it hit an iceberg for right now. And let's not.
Yeah, we're going to go with the historically supposedly accurate portrayal, so we're going to stick to that. But this was back on April 14th, 1912. That's when the Titanic sank. This woman was on it, and she was actually returning to America after a six-week vacation with her mother, Pauline. They had been, I guess, over traveling in Europe, traveling in France, and then she was recalled by a film studio called Eclair to start shooting a different film in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Which is also interesting because we've talked about Fort Lee and all of these other forts around the New York metropolitan area. So she had just finished a game of Bridge Whist, which I have no idea. Is it bridge? Is it some kind of quick version of bridge? I have no idea.
Actually, what bridge this is the OG game of bridge. It was Bridge Whist before it was ever bridge.
Okay. But I have never even tried to play bridge. The game that I guess I've come the closest to that comes the closest is like hearts or clubs or whatever. Which I think is similar to bridge. I think.
I have no idea because I've never played it.
So, and so they're playing in this first class saloon. And then she goes to bed that she shared with her mom. And she said that she heard this long, drawn out, like sickening kind of scrunch, crunch, which would then lead me to believe that there was actually an iceberg.
That she heard, like a scrunch, that does sound like that the ship had to have hit something, but people still, they talk about, well, what caused them to hit it? Because this Titanic was venturing into iceberg water and they were given so many warnings and yet they pressed ahead and it just makes you wonder why.
Yeah. And it also makes you wonder later, like why nobody helped them. So maybe they didn't know J.P. Morgan wasn't on board.
But you know who was on board? A different man. He was supposedly the richest man in the whole world at the time. He was on it. So did no one care about him? Because they were sending up flares and all kind of stuff. And there was this one ship called the Californian or something that sailed right past him. And they were like, la, 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 we don't see your flares. But you know they did.
Yes. And she noted the time as being about 20 minutes till midnight. And she grabbed her sweater and headed to the ship's deck to investigate what was going on. And then on the way to the deck, she realized, hey, this boat feels and it appears to be sideways. And since it was late evening, Gibson and her bridge buddies, who involved a New York banker and stuff, were some of the few passengers that were actually awake. So when she got up to the deck, it was really quiet. But based on what she saw and heard, she kind of figured out that something awful had happened. And although she wasn't exactly alarmed, because, you're thinking this is the biggest ship that's ever built. It's its maiden voyage. It's supposed to be indestructible. So I could see why she wouldn't be alarmed. She knew to go get her mom and her friends. And, once they rushed back to the deck. So this is the interesting thing to me. So they were awake. She goes to her cabin. She hears the scrunch. She goes to the deck. Then she goes back to get her mom. It just shows you how slow people were because they boarded lifeboat number 7 and fled the doomed ship. And like you said, it was the first, lifeboat out, released or whatever. I thought that
she was really lucky because the Titanic was built to hold as many lifeboats as they needed, to accommodate people. But the designer of the boat did not like how it cosmetically looked. So he took the lifeboats off. He left just a select few. And so she got on the first lifeboat, but people that came in after her, when the panic ensued, they were fighting each other. They were punching each other in the face. All kind of stuff was going on.
Yeah, because she said that the deck was listing as water flooded the boiler room, and then it caused the ship to sink even more quickly. I read something about they did a lifeboat test right before they left, and they only tested like one or two of them or something like that, which I thought, okay, that's kind of, it's the first time you're ever, taking the ship out. Perhaps you would like to test them all, just in case. Are you that confident of its ability to not sink? And
well, yeah, because they advertised the Titanic as absolutely unsinkable. And people, when they boarded it, they believed that.
So lifeboat number 7 retracted from the Titanic and hit the seawater around 12:40 a.m. So it took her an hour for her to be in the, she hears the scrunch at 11:40. So it takes an hour. And she's still in the first lifeboat. And it carried 19 or 20 passengers, including Gibson, her mother, and the two bridge partners. And it was meant to hold 65 people. I mean, that's a lot of extra people that could have been saved.
Well, yeah, they started dropping the lifeboats into the water, you know, without even being half full. And then that became a big controversy because they could have saved more lives. But, you know, in their head, these people were really rich, you know, the highest socialites and bankers and things like that. They were like, no, if we have the correct amount of people on board, you know, it'll turn over, it'll drown us. You know, it's very just self-serving of them.
Yeah, I mean, if something's meant to hold 65 people and you got like 20 in there, they're, you know, 65, you know, it shows you that these lifeboats were really fairly large. I mean, to hold 65 people, you know, this is not just some kind of little lifeboat you see, you know, on a tiny ship. These were massive.
They were, but they didn't test them out. And the problem is that as they are dropping these lifeboats full of people into the frigid water below, the people are looking down and they're trying to figure out why their lifeboat is filling up with, again, frigid water. And it's because these lifeboats didn't have plugs. You know, most of them, the plugs are missing, and you got to have that in order to stay buoyant.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this first group with Ms. Gibson on it, I mean, they look down and they go, okay, the lifeboat's taking on some water here. And, you know, good on them for recognizing the fact that the plug was missing and, you know, what it was going. And so they knew that if they didn't fix the problem, they would sink and die. And so that's when the men and women just began stripping off their lingerie and undergarments in order to plug the hole. I'm thinking to myself, okay, so you're wearing your clothes, and then somehow while you're on a lifeboat rocking, it's the middle of the night, it's cold, you see the thing, and somehow you're managing to get off your underwear and stuff while leaving your other clothes on. And I'm just trying to picture how all of this worked, you know?
Well, they say, ma'am, what are you wearing under your clothes? You're like, excuse me? And he's like, no, ingenuity. Take off your bra.
I know. Start
plugging the hole. And you're just like, okay, yeah, you got it.
And they watched where people were, you know, jumping off the ship into the water, dying of hypothermia. And, you know, it doesn't sound from anything that she said that they tried to help anybody get into a boat.
Well, you can't. See, the problem is when someone is drowning, or especially a large group of people are drowning, if you go to help them, you try to pull them into your boat, you're going to flip the boat over and kill everyone in it. That's just the way it goes. And people that are drowning, if they go to grab onto you, they will pull you down because they're in hysterics. And, you know, this is why when someone's drowning in a pool, if they're struggling, you want to hand them like a pole or something, you know, unless you're an adult and you can jump in and get your child. But I mean, if they're the same, you know, height and weight as you, you want to hand them something, you know, like a pole to pull them in, or throw them a life preserver. Don't die trying to save someone.
And she said, she gave an interview after to Moving Picture World, which shows you, first of all, the name of the magazine, Moving Picture World, that they hadn't called them movies yet. It was just Moving Picture World. She said, I'll never forget the terrible cry that rang out from people who were thrown into the sea and others who were afraid for their loved ones. And I mean, that must have been like so much screaming and where are you? And because it's the middle of the night. And people get, you know, they get awakened by all of this happening, and, you know, people are jumping off the ship and, you know, what's going on and everything. And she said, you know, I'll never ride in my little gray car again, because she was traumatized. Which, you know, you can certainly understand. And they were rescued about 5.5 hours later by the ship Carpathia. And, you know, like you said, it was one of the few ships that actually showed up to help rescue survivors. You know, you had ships sailing past, and then other ships that were thought to be in the vicinity either ignored the distress calls or slept through them.
Since it was so late at night, you also had the passenger ships where people were asleep. So if there was any type of radio distress signals going out, they were just sleeping through them.
And it's interesting that none of those passenger ships happened to hit an iceberg or anything like that. But I always thought, you know, when you watch movies and things, you always hear that, oh, somebody's in trouble, somebody's distressed, we have to go help them. It's the code of the sea or whatever, you know? It just kind of, and maybe that's just for movies. Maybe that's just not real life, you know? Because I think that they had the opportunity to save a lot more people than they did. And like you said, I mean, the ship, the California or whatever, just, no, we don't see anything. you know?
Yeah, it came out later that they just didn't want to get involved or something. You know, they're like, oh, no, not my scene. And, you know, I don't know what that's about.
And the whole women and children thing kind of went out the door, too, because she said that, you know, this late night bridge game was a lifesaver because if she and the other players had not stayed up past bedtime finishing the game, they would have been fast asleep in their beds and maybe they would have been stuck below deck and trampled by stampeding crowds. And she escaped with her bridge buddies were Frederick Kimber Stewart, who was a New York lawyer, and William Sloper, who was a prominent stockbroker. So, you know, no sense waiting for the other women. These two guys are just like, let's go, you know?
Yeah. And at first, the Sloper guy, he was reluctant to leave the ship because he was arguing with her. You know, it's unsinkable. You know, it's the Titanic. And she's like, look, I've seen water pouring into the boiling room. And there's no way that what I saw, like that the ship can survive that. There's just no way. And then there was something about maybe a fire that was also burning. And she's like, look, there's a lot going on and you need to get in the boat. And he did. But one thing was that he never lived down the rumor that he may have dressed as a woman in order to board that boat. It was like you said, yeah, woo, it was women and children only. So did the banker and the stockbroker borrow some garments, you know, put a little scarf over their head or whatever, or hat, because she had big hats that had the bows that you tie and everything. Did they try to pass themselves off as women? It is something that especially Sloper went on to fight the rest of his life. I mean, it became to where he couldn't go to bars and get served. He couldn't go to restaurants for a while because everyone was judging him.
Well, I got a question about that. And, you know, this kind of goes back to the case that we had where Marie Empress or whatever, you know, what happened to her? Did she dress up as a man or whatever? But where did Sloper? Okay, so we're in the middle of the night, right? And you have Dorothy and she goes, you know, I guess goes and knocks on their doors and says, come on, you know, the ship is sinking. Where does Sloper get the women's clothes from in the middle of the night?
Well, it was they were in the first class cabin section and she shared a cabin with her mother. And who's next door? Sloper. And who's next door to him? The other guy. So perhaps she went into her room and said, here, throw this on very quickly. And, you know, let's go. I will always assume that she handed them a hat or a dress or something like that because they did all go back downstairs to collect whatever. You know, I'm sure it wasn't much, but they did grab stuff. And I think that's when they grabbed the clothing.
And it's just, you know, that an hour later, an hour after the crunch, you know, they're still the first ones. It shows you how slow this whole process was that you have this ship sinking in the middle of the night and they're the first, but it's been an hour. And, well, you know, I mean,
the upshot was that she was up and she was able to decipher that something bad was happening. The downside was that the crew had no idea how anything on the ship functioned. They didn't know how to undo the lifeboats and things like that. So it probably took them an hour to figure out how to even make that happen.
Now, from what you found, from what I found, it doesn't look like Gibson ever talked about whether or not Sloper and Stewart were dressed as women.
No, and they didn't address it. And, you know, when she went on to do a film, she didn't address it in that either, which is also kind of telling.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, she was traumatized. So think about this. You're going back to New York because you're supposed to be in a movie. And you go back to New York and you're thinking it's going to be one movie. But instead, she goes back to New York to begin filming the one real drama Saved from the Titanic, where she plays a fictional version of herself. And this is not even a month after the Titanic has sunk. I mean, talk about getting something out quickly, you know, and it was the first movie to be based on the ship and producers wanted to get it out while the tragedy was still fresh. I mean, you know, Hollywood, even back in 1912, you know, let's exploit a tragedy.
I know, right? Nothing screams thirsty to cash in like rushing a production because the whole thing wrapped in literally a week. And I don't think by any account this woman was ready to film something like that.
No. And you know what? She wore the exact same sweater and clothing that was on her back when she escaped the ship. So, you know, she has got, I mean, just these memories, you know, she's got them. She's putting them back on. I can't imagine what she was feeling when she's wearing the same exact clothes.
Yeah, same exact clothes and a clear Studios, they went and they got this replica ship and they set it in the New York Harbor, and that's where they filmed, and it was very realistic looking. And they said that she would cry and then get on the ship, and then she would cry when she got off the ship. So it was really hard to get through scenes with her. And, you know, they shot for a whole week just to make a 10-minute film. You know, that's all you got to see with just 10 minutes.
10 minutes, and it premiered in the U.S. 29 days after the Titanic sank. 29 days! And then, of course, like a lot of these silent films, you know, the tragedy is that all the reels from the film were lost to the Eclair studio fire in March 1914. And, you know, it's a lost film, and there's so many lost films. I don't want to discount it. There are thousands of lost films. But if you think about the subject matter, if you think about who was starring in it, if you think about just because she co-wrote the script, if you think about just what she brought to it, the fact that that film is lost for all time, you know, that's why it's considered one of the greatest losses of the silent era, because it's just so contemporaneous of the situation. And I think it would be really, you know, nice to still have that thing around.
Yeah, and to also see her act, because the only silent film that has survived is the 1912 one that she filmed called The Lucky Holdup. And I looked at parts of it, and you can tell that it is corroded so bad. You know, they have preserved it as much as they can, but just watching it, it's kind of painful. You know, just not even just the aspect that it's hard to watch, but also just the fact that we've lost so much over the years.
Yeah, and it's because, you know, what they used on the film, it burned and it just destroyed everything. Now, President Taft had a friend in military aid named Archibald Butt, which is quite the name. It's not like Dick Cox from the Bewitched episode, but Archibald Butt goes right there. Archie Butt, who perished on the Titanic. And so Taft got a personal copy of Saved from the Titanic. So it might still be out there.
It has to be. I don't see Taft throwing something like that away. He really, really liked that aid, you know, the military aid that perished. And I just feel like that he would have held on to that forever and then had the estate. He preserved it. It's probably, you know, it's probably somewhere in a museum or something and no one knows. It's probably been cataloged incorrectly. They should probably go look for that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, like I mentioned, presidential library earlier. They didn't do presidential libraries for, you know, until, I don't know, 1960, I'm probably getting it wrong, 64, something like that. So Taft, you know, what he would have done is he would have given all his records or whatever to, I think he's from Ohio, I'm probably wrong, but I think he's from Ohio, so he probably would have given it all to Ohio State or something like that, all of his records and everything. So it's probably wherever he gave everything, and probably if somebody would be willing to go look through it, you know, because they're looking for things of, you know, presidential stuff. They're not really looking for a copy of a movie about the Titanic. But you would think that somebody would have seen it by now. They would have thought, oh, this is a recording.
I don't know if people really, you know, it takes someone who really wants to invest in the topic. You know, if you really like Dorothy Gibson or you are a silent film history fan, those kind of people will go out and look for it. You know, if you tell them about it, I don't know who has sat around and thought about Saved from the Titanic, but it's got to be out there. I mean, they find stuff all the time from different estates, whether it be celebrity or, you know, politically linked estates, you know, that to this day, they're still recovering things that they thought were lost.
Yeah. And, you know, people, you know, somebody might watch it. You know, here's what I can see. Somebody's in the library, wherever they have it at this university, and they're looking at film reels because they want to see film reels of Taft, maybe giving a speech or something or whatever. And they go, oh, this is a movie. It's not anything about Taft. And they don't think about it in the terms of, you know, oh my gosh, I wonder if anybody knows that this is, you know, the film Saved from the Titanic, because they're just focused on the presidential aspect, the historical thing, and not so much about some silent film about a ship sinking. You know?
Yeah. And then I also wonder if it's in one of those canisters to where it became just so corroded, you know, maybe they gave him the same type of copy that they would use. And then, I don't know, what if somebody opened it and they're like, okay, this is gross. And then they threw it away.
Yeah. And, you know, you had mentioned that Gibson, you know, obviously was crying a lot and, you know, depressed during the movie. But her manager and also this guy named Jules Brulator, they wanted her to finish. And so she went on to finish, but then had a nervous breakdown and she divorced her husband, who was a pharmacist. And the problem is it's, she was never given time to process what she lived because it just happened so soon after the Titanic went down. You know, just...
And yeah, I mean, her manager was the driving force behind her. And then, of course, the Brulator guy, he was another driving force because he went on to fund Saved from the Titanic. So he had a financial interest in the film and he needed to make sure that she followed through.
Her film career only started a year earlier. And, you know, she was just getting parts as a film extra. But then Brulator and her, you know, all of a sudden they're started hooking up. And then the next thing, you know, Brulator, of course, is just kind of, then all of a sudden she gets parts, you know, and this guy, Brulator, is a very, historical figure in Hollywood. He was the head of distribution of Eastman Kodak, of course, who made the film and stuff, but he co-founded Universal Pictures. So the same Universal Pictures you see now, he's the one who founded it. And it was called something else, Universal something, but it became Universal Pictures. And, you know, she became a star. And, you know, he was 19 years her senior and he was working as an advisor and producer for Eclair. And, you know, she went from 1911 where she was just doing an extra thing. She starts hooking up with Brulator. And the next thing you know, she's the highest paid movie actress at the time. You know, it just.
Yeah. She was running alongside Mary Pickford, who was sweetheart of, you know, that era.
Exactly. And I mean, Mary Pickford still today is known. Dorothy Gibson, not so much. But, you know, Mary Pickford is all over Hollywood, you know, whether it's the Pickfair Estate and things like that. I mean, just Mary Pickford is Hollywood. So it shows you like these two divergent kind of things. And it also is because Mary Pickford got to stay in Hollywood and Dorothy went somewhere else. But nobody knew about Dorothy and Brulator being together, but she, took his car out for a spin and she struck and killed a pedestrian. And during the court case, it was revealed that she was Brulator's mistress. And his wife had a suspicion that he was cheating on her, but this confirmed it. So she sued him for divorce, which took several years. I mean, several years. And this was messy, because of how much money he had. And, but, you know, so it finalized in 1915 and then Gibson and Brulator got married in 1917.
Yeah, so Gibson, she had a nervous breakdown after the filming concluded. And, you know, that's what led her to jump in the sports car. And then she went on to kill someone. But, I mean, truly reliving that whole experience from the Titanic made her lose her mind because, you know, she ends up divorcing her husband. She's having an affair with, this film producer and the two go on to marry. You know, once he got a divorce, it opened the door for them to marry. But I remember something that you said in previous episodes about how celebrities that start off in affairs, they don't stay together because, you know, once one of them gets divorced, the whole secret mystery of, you know, sleeping together, no one knowing, that's not exciting anymore, you know, because it's gone.
Yeah, and they also got married because they had to, in this sense. Brulator was very rich. He was reportedly worth several million dollars, and he was increasingly powerful politically. And so that year, in 1917, when they got married, he was appointed to some kind of executive committee about motion picture industry and kind of things. And he was making propaganda films because, remember, World War One was going on. And so because he now all of a sudden had this high profile in Washington, D.C., okay, you know, you can't be just have a girlfriend. So then he had to legitimize the relationship with Dorothy. So then they got married on July 6, 1917, which was one week before his first conference with the president at the time, President Woodrow Wilson, and also the Treasury Secretary. So, you know, that's kind of why he had to get married. And this is another interesting little tidbit about this. So there was kind of these financial troubles and arguments that happened almost immediately. And there was this guy who said, hey, you know, Brulator, you're being bribed and all this kind of stuff. And that person was William Randolph Hearst, which, of course, they made the movie Citizen Kane about. And Orson Welles based this horrible female character on a combination of Dorothy Gibson and Brulator's then wife. So it's just kind of interesting that Orson Welles also wanted to take a dig into them and everything like that.
That is super interesting.
It is. And he married the actress was Hope Hampton. And one of the great stories about that is that, you know, Brulator knew everybody. I mean, millions of dollars at that time, you know, you're traveling in high circles. And so I guess, I don't know if it was their honeymoon or whatever, but Hope and Brulator were visiting an Egyptian sheikh. And he was offered, Brulator was offered 10,000 British pounds in exchange for allowing the sheikh to buy his wife. And Brulator said, "My wife's jewels are worth more than that." So it just, you know, it just kind of thing. And it's just, so when, before he married Hope, so he obviously has to get divorced from Dorothy. But the thing about it is that when he got married to Dorothy, it made his first wife really angry. And she said that the marriage to Dorothy was illegal because Brulator had got a divorce in Kentucky instead of New York, where Brulator lived. And so, you know, I said that, you know, the divorce was finalized in 1915, but in 1917, when Dorothy married Brulator, then all of a sudden the wife was really, really ticked. And so then it really didn't get dissolved until 1919. And that's also the same time that the divorce with Dorothy kind of happened too. And she was allowed to get alimony, and she was also permitted the use of the Brulator name. Although I don't think that she, you know, actually did. So it just, I mean.
Wow. He had a lot to deal with.
He did. He did. And, you know, and he, after, you know, all that, he just kind of, okay, I'm just going to kind of stay quiet and stuff. And his wife was known as the Duchess of Park Avenue in the society columns because she just devoted every, if you can think about somebody in the 30s and the 40s and, you know, every single Broadway premiere, and there's Hope, you know, and lavishly dressed and all of these kind of things. And the only other thing that's really interesting about Brulator, which is I can't find more than a mention of it, was in 1939, so right before World War II started, he was wounded by a would-be assassin who he refused to identify. But by then he wasn't really doing a lot of stuff. So I just wonder who wanted to assassinate him and why he refused to identify who it was.
Yeah. I mean, did he know the person, or
was I don't know.
Operative that he worked with? What does he mean he won't identify them? Man, they almost killed you.
I know. So anyway, let's get back to Dorothy.
Well, with all that information, that really helps me understand Dorothy's next steps, because with Brulator's wife being a very, you know, elite socialite and someone that could possibly ruin your life and has a lot of media connections, you know, they go on to run Dorothy through the mud in all of the New York tabloids, and Dorothy has enough of it. And that's when she decides to leave film and pursue a choral career. I mean,
yeah,
she probably left film because, you know, her cash cow here, you know, she's breaking up with basically the film industry by leaving Mr. Universal Kodak.
You know,
what kind of parts was she going to get after, you know, messing him over? So, I mean, I could see why she'd start singing, but she leaves America. You know, she says goodbye to New York and she heads to Paris.
And she goes to Paris. And here is a World War II, like I said. It's, you know, 1939. It was September 1st when Germany invaded Poland. So that kind of gives you an idea. September 1st, 1939. And she goes to Paris. And you remember, France fell shortly thereafter. And she's there during World War II. And there's a logical reason in a way, because her ex, remember, had all of these dealings with the War Department and propaganda films. And he was given the highest medal that you can give by the French government for his service during World War One. So perhaps Dorothy was a spy. You know?
Yeah, because I mean, it's her choice to go stay in a Nazi occupied territory. And then things start coming out about what type of work she was really doing over there. And, you know, like the neat thing about her, right, is that in 1912, she was like one of the first celebrities ever to meet with fans in order to promote a film. She had The Revenge of the Silk Mask. So she was out. And the media, you know, caught her meeting with fans and stuff. So that makes her like a first. But then, like, the least likely thing to like about her is the fact that she was a Nazi sympathizer, mm-hmm. you know, or so people say. And that makes people think that she was, you know, some type of spy for Germany.
Yeah, you know, and she renounced her involvement in 1944, but only after like a stroke of bad luck that resulted in her arrest for being an anti-fascist agitator. And she was imprisoned in a Milan prison. So we've got her going from Paris and now she's in a Milan jail. And, you know, what did she do? Who did she anger to get thrown in there?
Yeah,
and
because...
then, it's crazy.
No, I mean, go ahead and tell him, like, who helps her out? It makes it even more suspicious.
Because there's a double agent who broke her out. And she was able to escape alongside two other prisoners. Always escaping with two other people, isn't she?
How did she know a double agent? You know, did they send for her? Was she one of them? I kind of think she was.
Yeah, I think she was a spy for sure. And to have a double agent be the one to know where you were in a Milan prison who breaks you out of the jail because you're that important, or you know something. And, you know, and it's a lot of people find it interesting that she was this German sympathizer who just happened to be on the Titanic, just happened to be one of the few up late that night and the very first off the ship, you know?
Yeah, because when you start thinking about how the Titanic might have really sank, you know, outside of the historical portrayal, you know, the whole German situation looks really suspicious. If there was a U-boat out in the water or anything like that, you know, I'm really looking at her as to how she knew to be up and also how she was the first on a lifeboat.
And how it appears, if you go back to Stewart and Sloper or whatever, it almost, you know, she said it's kind of like she had this advanced warning. Okay. Because who's going to think that clearly that these guys need to be dressed up as women? You know?
Yeah, that group seems really well prepared. And the fact that the men would go along with it and, you know, the Titanic was supposed to be unsinkable and she's able to talk these two, you know, powerful, a broker and also a banker into getting on the boat. You know, what if they had said, no, you know, we'll take our chances. You know, we believe in this boat. But, you know, they went with her. You know, it doesn't seem like they put up too much of a fight. So, I mean.
And remember, that's a couple years before World War I starts. And if she's a German sympathizer and you have this banker and all of this kind of stuff and, you know, somebody that can help down the road, it's just kind of interesting. And then she suffered a heart attack 1946. So the year after World War II ends and died at the Hotel Ritz in Paris. So had some money. She's living in the Hotel Ritz in Paris and, you know, she was only 56 at the time and, you know, there wasn't a lot of drinking or anything that, you know, I could find. So was this heart attack triggered by poison?
I don't know, because a lot of the spies were getting poisoned back then. You know, when you look at the history, especially the German spies, you know, they were dropping like crazy. So when I see heart attack and I look at her age, you know, yeah, the prison life was hard, and yes, she could have died of a natural heart attack, but looking at who she was spending time with, you know, she had that lover stationed at the Spanish embassy, and when you look at, again, historical timeline of what the Spanish embassy was up to at that time, again, more questions.
Yeah, I mean, he worked as a press attaché, which just screams, I'm a spy. And it's, you know, speculated she never gave up spying, and, you know, perhaps her lover was an extension of that. You know, there's no definitive answers or anything like that. But it, to me, it sounds like she lived her entire time in Europe as some kind of spy and led this glamorous life that it doesn't seem as if she would have the money to. I don't know how much her husband gave her in alimony. Obviously, he was rich. But it just seems like
she would have had to have made off in her divorces like a bandit because she's not working. It doesn't mention anywhere in her bio that she went on to pursue a different type of career. I mean, how much could choral singing have paid? You know, where was she getting all this money?
It kind of blows my mind. Okay. So, but speaking of poison, I mean, the curse of the Titanic wasn't limited to old Hollywood. No, it found its way to New Hollywood, too.
It did, because in 1996, James Cameron, who is absolutely obsessed with shipwrecks, you know, he decides he's going to get in on the whole Titanic thing and, you know, he's going to film his own movie. And this is the one where, you know, everyone loves it because it's so romantic. He has a Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet.
Who could fit on the door, by the way? He could fit on the piece of wood. Okay, I just had to say that.
Very true.
I think that at that exhibit that I was talking about, they actually had the size of the door or whatever, the piece of wood. So you could see if people could actually fit on it. So
yeah, he could have clearly fit on that. What was his name in the movie? Was it Jack Dawson?
Yeah, something. Okay. I've only ever seen the movie once.
Oh, so. Okay. No offense to James Cameron. I don't like the movie. I don't like the song. It all makes me crazy. But the whole Jack Dawson thing, like, people thought that that was a real character that, you know, was exactly as portrayed in the movie. And that part is fictional. But there is an actual Jack Dawson that was on the Titanic and died. And he was actually a crew member. So all of these girls were going to the cemetery where he was buried. And they were weeping over his grave. And his family just thought that was so funny because, you know, he has absolutely nothing to do with any type of romantic plot.
So while they were filming, in Nova Scotia in 1996, there was this cast and crew. It was about 50 of them. And they were served lobster chowder by the on-set catering company. And within about 15 minutes of consuming this chowder, people realized something was wrong. Slowly, one by one, the cast and crew were transported to the local area hospital. And everybody thought, okay, well, this is just some food poisoning because, you know, it was shellfish. But it wasn't food poisoning. It was something a little bit more sinister. And so the police department got involved.
Yeah, and because they ran the toxicology and it came back and they're like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. The crew had been drugged with PCP, like angel dust. And, I mean, and suspicion fell on this food service worker who had recently been fired from the catering company. And the catering company says, no, no, no. And the CEO of the company said, hey, it was the Hollywood crowd bringing in the psychedelic shit. I don't think it was purposely done to hurt somebody. It was done like a party thing that got carried away. And it was even suggested that maybe an angry crew member spiked the chowder because they wanted to get back at James Cameron, who, you know, let's face it, is not the most friendly of sorts on a set. You know, and I mean, there were some big members of the crew that, you know, Bill Paxton, he said, I was going to eat Italian food in my trailer, but, you know, at the last minute, I decided to join Cameron for a bowl of lobster chowder. And within 15 minutes, he goes, the crew was all milling about. Some people were laughing. Some people were crying. Some people were throwing up. One minute I felt okay, and the next minute I felt so goddamn anxious I wanted to breathe in a paper bag. I mean, I can just imagine what it was like, you know?
I mean, you can't not laugh because, I mean, it's funny. It reminds me of when you were telling the story about how the CIA, they sometimes spike their punch, you know, like for New Year's or Christmas or something, and they're like, hey, look, you guys, leave the freaking punch alone this year. And then it just became like a punch between me and Inti to say, don't drink the punch.
Don't drink the punch. And there was one guy, a crew member said that Cameron's eyes were so red that it looked like he'd been sniffing glue since he was four.
That's just my favorite quote out of like the whole story.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
And then Cameron told Vanity Fair that after eating the chowder, he was standing in the middle of a set and he realized he couldn't find his way out of the set, even though he knew it so well. And he was like woozy and everything like that. And then the cast and the crew were put in separate observation areas with curtains around them, but they were all so wasted that no one would stay in their area. And so people were like in the hallway and some were racing each other in wheelchairs down the hallways because they were so wasted. They did a conga line with Bill Paxton in the middle. I mean, it's just kind of, and then you had, the director of production, Caleb Deschanel, and he was supposedly leading the conga line, although he denies it. And, people were collapsing on tables and gurneys. Cameron got stabbed in the face with a pen by a crew member at one point. I mean, this is,
he didn't even know to be upset because he was so high. He said, all I could do was sit there and laugh.
Yeah. And he was bleeding and laughing and just looking at it. And this investigation went on for 2 years. But the police were never able to identify the person who did it or, you know, if anyone was being specifically targeted. And, you know, the case was eventually closed, you know, and it could have been a prank that went awry. I mean, nobody had any long-term harm, I guess. And they started filming the next day again. So I don't know.
Yeah, but it's a funny story and no one got hurt. So, I mean, that's why we can laugh.
But the Titanic curse could be a thing. I mean, Kate Winslet went on to chip her elbow bone, and almost drowned. after her coat got caught during like a rushing water scene. And Cameron says, oh, she was never really drowning, but he wanted her to think that she was. I mean,
yeah, he sounds real understanding. He's like, yeah, you know, she just thought she was drowning, and I wanted her to feel that way. And the whole time Kate Winslet's talking about sitting in her dressing room going, I just want to die. I hate the set.
I know. And Cameron said that she was just being dramatic. You know, I told you before, I mean, it takes a long time to get to the Titanic. I guess it takes about 8 days. And few people have ever seen it, but James Cameron is one of the few. And once you're at the correct coordinates, you enter submersible and you travel 12,000 feet below sea level for 90 minutes, which I would never do in a million years.
No, because you have to go through all those different emotions. You know, you have to freak out from fear and then you start crying. And then they just talk about you go through all these different emotions before you reach acceptance. So I imagine everyone that you're submersed with, like you all freaking hate each other by the time you reach the bottom because you've went through all of that stuff together. And, you know, that would be kind of unnerving for someone to be melting down beside you.
And Cameron, though, spent over 17 hours studying it. And he said he absorbed not only sadness, but great responsibility to get the film right. And that he assumed multiple jobs in the set. And, you know, it made him a monster. And, you know, he's got that temper and the screaming fits and gave him the name Scariest Man in Hollywood. I mean, not a fun guy. You know, it's weird when you have a method director. It's different if you have a method actor, but a method director who's just terrorizing people and, oh, I wanted you to feel like you're going to die, but I wasn't going to let you die.
Winslet said that on set she was genuinely frightened of him.
Yeah, you know. And if you think about that, they're just making a fake movie, you know, don't have any real experience with the Titanic, but you had Dorothy who had to do that, who had to make the movie, you know, that came out 29 days after it sank. You know, she gets to New York. We want you to write this script. Do you got your clothes that you're wearing? Wear those. Let's make this movie.
That's kind of victimizing someone all over again. I mean, can you imagine someone goes through you're a victim of something, a crime, and the crime would be that the captain continued on despite warnings, and then, you know, she has to survive that, and then they're like, oh, by the way, can you wear the clothes you were victimized in? I mean, God.
It's nuts. It's nuts. Well, that is, you know, I could spend an hour just wondering if Dorothy was a spy or not, so... I mean,
I'm curious too, but I think she was.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it goes all the way back to the... I think she was on the spy payroll. Someone was keeping her up.
Yeah. And I wonder if it went all the way back to 1912 or not.
It probably was. That's probably why she was really on the Titanic, and the whole actress thing is just her cover story.
Yeah. It could be, you know, getting in bed with this guy who's one of the richest men in the world. And then the richest man in the world was on the Titanic, and she had spent this mysterious time in Europe. Even though she wasn't, you know, you never know. She was being recruited, trained, and her first job was the Titanic. Anyway.
Very mysterious. And that Titanic story with Cameron is my favorite drug story ever. I think that it is
it's a good one.
Hilarious.
You stabbed me in the face with a pen.
and I'm bleeding out, but it's fine because everything's funny right now.
I know. Well, I can't wait to see what we find next week. And I hope that you have a very lovely weekend, and I hope that everybody stays safe.
Yeah, stay safe, and thank you.
I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Bye.